It is so good to be here. It is so good to have the opportunity, as Zane talked about in our first sermon, to start a new year, and I'm gonna steal his line, insert transition joke here. I couldn't think of a good one either. See, when we do that, I'm gonna reveal something, I'm gonna embarrass Zane here. When we say insert joke here, that's because we couldn't think of one. And we tried really hard, and we couldn't think of one. And so I'm embarrassing myself, but I'm mostly embarrassing Zane. But it's good to be here. It is good to have the opportunity to put a past year behind us to start a new year. And with any new year, there is a sense of a fresh start, of putting aside some of the burdens and some of the frustrations of the past year. And there's a sense, even if it's a little bit of a contrived sense, that there's a new start, that there's a new opportunity, there are fresh things afoot. And so at the request of several people, I wanted to kind of start our year in perhaps a little bit of an unorthodox way, because most of the time when we start a new year, we want to start with a theme or something really positive and get us all pumped up, and I'm going to talk about sin. And maybe that's not traditional. But we've had the opportunity over the past year to look at a couple of different thematic approaches to the Bible, a couple of different opportunities for looking deep into the text and everything. There's been some requests to kind of, in some ways, a little bit go back to some basics. And I think there's always a good time to do that. And I think there's always need to do that, to remind ourselves of what it is we're doing. And one of the things that is just a reality of human nature is that we struggle with sin. And sin is not something that when you're dunked underneath the water and you raise up, you're like, hey, it's no longer an issue anymore. Turns out I was able to get baptized and it's all gone. That's never how it happens. We all continue to struggle with the various demons and the various issues that we have in our life. And as Zane talked about this morning, as we're dealing with the idea of unity, I think this actually goes well with that, because part of our unity is working through those things together. Part of our unity is realizing that we all face struggles, some of them similar, some of them different. But part of the strength of God's people is in having the courage to, one, identify the problems we face in our life. There's no fear of losing face. There's no fear of somehow being thought less than everyone else, because sin is something we all struggle with. But there's also the conviction that God's Spirit within us is at work to remove some of these sins, that God's Spirit is at work to change us from being those fallible, broken people into a new creation. And so while it is God's work within us that changes us and makes us holy, we want to make sure we're not getting in the way of that. So what we're going to do over the next couple of weeks is we're going to look at a series of sins, a series of issues that can arise. And you've probably heard this conceived as the seven deadly sins. And I think that is a terrible name for this collection of things. First and foremost, because I think there's actually eight of them. When this idea was first conceived, and I'm going to go ahead and give a clarification here, this listing is not necessarily, you can't go to one verse that says, here are these eight particular problems. And I think that's part of the silliness of calling these the seven deadly sins. These are not the worst sins that you can commit. Murder is not going to be on the list, which I think we all agree is probably in the top five of the worst things you can do, is to deprive another human being of their life. And so the person who actually first conceived of this and kind of compiled this list didn't call them the deadly sins. He called them, and I think this is fascinating, the eight dangerous thoughts. I think that's a really interesting way of putting it. And his logic for this was that these particular issues tend to be breeding grounds for other problems. And these passions, these thoughts, these ideas, they tend to be something that a lot of people struggle with. And so these tend to be very good things for people to focus on and to think on so that we can work against these ideas, so that we can identify how the Spirit is attempting to work through us to produce discipline and self-control. And so what we're going to do with this series is look at some of these dangerous thoughts, some of these things that perhaps they're even good intention, but somehow they've become twisted, somehow they've become corrupted, and they can become a breeding ground for sin and destructive things. And so we want to look at these series of issues and ask ourselves, one, are we dealing with this? And let's properly identify what the Bible says about this sin, properly identify what the problem is, and then what we really want to focus on is what's the next step. Because with any sin, it is not enough to just say, this is a sin, don't do it. Paul says, if I could just not sin, I wouldn't. He says in Romans chapter 7, he goes, the problem is that I am weak before the flesh. And he says, but thanks be to God that He gives strength. And so the point of this is not merely to identify sin and say don't do it, but to give us practical steps in how can we push back against these negative influences in our life. How can we push back and how can we create room for the Spirit to work in us and to grow us and to change us into a new person. And so we're going to start with one, and it's one that I think is a fascinating one because it's one we typically don't talk about. Gluttony. Now, anybody who is visually looking at me right now thinks, are you really the guy to talk to us about gluttony? And I'm going to give a word of assurance to the other fellow fat people in the audience. Gluttony is not the same thing as being fat. Now, there's some connection between those two ideas, but you can be a thin person and be a glutton. Let's actually look at what the Bible talks about with gluttony and what it is. Turn over, if you will, to Proverbs chapter 23. Now, perhaps you do this sometimes after a lesson. Perhaps you're nerdy like I am. Perhaps when you do a word study or you're looking at a particular idea, you go to something like a Bible Gateway or a research Bible, and you're like, I wonder all the passages that talk about gluttony. I'm going to save you some time. There's not a lot of passages that use that particular word. And there's some reason for that. It tends to be talked more as an idea. And we're going to look at a couple of examples of what I think are examples of gluttony. But here's one of the passages that does talk about gluttony and does talk about it as a problem. And so the author of Proverbs in chapter 23 and verse 20 says to his student, do not be with heavy drinkers of wine or with gluttonous eaters of meat. For the heavy drinker and the glutton will come to poverty, and drowsiness will clothe one with rags. And so for the author of Proverbs, gluttony is in the same type of danger as being drunk. And that's interesting, because we don't tend to think of those two activities as a problem. And part of this, I think, is we don't have a great modern definition of gluttony. When we think of gluttony, we tend to think overeating. You're eating too much. You've eaten so much that you've lost control of your weight. You've eaten so much that you have given yourself a stomachache, and we think of that. When we think of gluttony, we think of Golden Corral buffet. And in some ways, there is some truth to that. There is some conception of that. But gluttony is not so much overeating, although that can be gluttony, as it is an inordinate desire, an improper desire related to food or drink. Gluttony is taking food and misprioritizing it in our life. So let me show you an example of what I would call gluttony that is not perhaps what we might traditionally think of. Turn over, if you will, to Numbers chapter 11. Numbers chapter 11 takes place very shortly after the people have spent a year at Mount Sinai. There's like this whole long section of Exodus and Leviticus and the first 10 chapters of Numbers that all takes place in this year in Mount Sinai, where essentially, the people of God are being formed, and the commandments are being given, the tabernacle is being built, priesthood is being instituted, and Israel is becoming the nation that's going to go into the promised land. And all of this looks really, really good, and Numbers chapter 10 ends with, okay, we're gonna start marching to Canaan, and Numbers chapter 11 is where it all falls apart. Like, immediately the step they take from Mount Sinai, it all starts to go downhill. The people complain. The Lord's anger is kindled against them, and they end up getting a bunch of people killed because of this. But then there's a second problem in Numbers chapter 11 and verse 4. It says, the rabble who were among them had greedy desires. Now, that phrase, the rabble, that's talking about the non-Israelites who came with Israel out of Egypt. There's actually a substantial portion of presumably Egyptian and other members of that nation that saw the power of God, were convicted by it, and actually went with Israel out of Egypt. One of those kind of little-known trivia facts. But it says, the rabble who were among them had greedy desires, and also the sons of Israel wept again and said, who will give us meat to eat? We remember the fish which we used to eat free in Egypt, the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic. But now our appetite is gone. There is nothing at all to look at except this manna. We know what manna is. Manna is one of the most incredible miracles that occurs in the Bible. where through His own power, Yahweh provides for an entire nation food to fill them every day. That's incredible. That 6 days out of the week, manna comes from the heaven and enough on the sixth day to feed them on the seventh. God cares deeply about His people. He's not going to let His people starve in the wilderness. And so He gives them manna, this substance that fills them and takes care of their needs. But it's kind of bland. We're given a description that basically, it's almost the closest conception that I kind of visualize. It's almost like a saltine cracker. That's like the taste that I kind of visualize. It's there, and it'll give you sustenance, but it's not exactly exciting. And they're about to eat it for 40 years. They're about to eat it for a long time. Even if they make it, you know, where they're supposed to be for to Canaan. I mean, you're talking about years of eating the exact same fairly bland dish, and everybody starts to grumble about it. They're like, man, remember in Egypt all the good food we had? The fish and the meat and the onions and the leeks and the garlic, fresh fruits and vegetables. Man, it was so much better than this manna. This is gluttony. It's not about how much they weigh. It's not about they're eating too much or too little. It's that food has become more important to them than God. That food, their lack of control of their appetite, has led them to prioritize slavery in Egypt as a better condition than living as a free people before God, sustained by His blessings. This is what gluttony looks like. It is when food becomes such a priority that it overrides your self-control. It is when the physical desire to sustain oneself becomes corrupted. Now, food is not a bad thing. The Bible talks consistently about how good food is a blessing. Ecclesiastes, as we looked at last week, it talks about one of the great blessings of God is to eat a good meal. And so the point of this lesson about gluttony is not to convince you that you have to never eat food again or that you have to only eat, you know, saltine crackers for the rest of your life. But we are going to look at how food can be misapplied. At how an obsession with food can severely and horribly hinder our dependence and our trust upon God. And that's really what we're concerned with this idea of gluttony, is an improper desire for food. And what I'm going to tell you is that this is not solely related to the idea of overeating. You can be a thin, very in shape person, and food can dominate your life. You may not even eat very much food. But food becomes such a focus in your life, it becomes the constant thing you're focused on, is how much you need to eat and what calories you need to count and how many of these things you need to eat. And well, you're worrying about what your next meal is, that it becomes your idol. And so don't confuse this. This is not talking about fatness. This is not talking about overeating. This is talking about an improper desire towards food, whether too much or too little. So let's look at a couple of passages that talk about the problems that gluttony can bring about. There was the passage that I was going to read. Proverbs 23, 20-21. Philippians 3, verse 18, has a phrase that I just think is so powerful in discussing this. And it's more than just food, and Paul is discussing a broader concept than just food. But he uses a phrase that I think is particularly relevant to this discussion when talking to the Philippians here in chapter 3. And he's drawing a contrast between those who live proper Christian lives where the focus of their life is on Christ and their life is defined by their relationship with Christ. And then in verse 18, he contrasts that. And in verse 17, we'll actually read, he says, "Brethren, join in following my example and observe those who walk according to the pattern you have in us. For many walk, of whom I often told you, and now tell you even weeping, that they are enemies of the cross of Christ, whose end is destruction, whose God is their appetite, and whose glory is in their shame, who set their minds on earthly things. For our citizenship is in heaven, from which also we eagerly wait for a Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, who will transform the body of our humble state into conformity with the body of His glory by the exertion of the answer of the power that He has even to subject all things to Himself. Whose God is their appetite." Some of you may have a translation that I think even better captures this idea. Whose God is their belly. Their gut. That's what they worship. It's just, it's that deep desire for stuff. And Paul, I think, is using this in broader terms than more than just simply food. But this is what we're talking about when our desires, when our physical goals become our end-all be-all, when our hunger rules us, we have no self-control. We have lost one of the great gifts of Christ, which is in freeing us from such concerns that we may purely focus on the good things of the kingdom. Now again, Paul's not saying food's bad. He's not saying don't eat. He is saying that when your desire, which has been planted in you by God, God gave us hunger as a good thing to remind us, hey, go eat something. Your body is hungry. You need nutrition. But when that good thing becomes corrupted and that desire becomes twisted, it becomes this idea of gluttony, where your God, your focus, your mental exertion is toward feeding your belly. And again, you could be thin and have the same problem. And so this is what we're talking about, and this is why Paul has such concern over food. It's a good thing, but food can become a point of contention. It can become a problem very easily. And Paul talks a lot about food. Just go study sometime through the epistles and look at how much Paul talks about food, about what it means to properly eat and drink before the Lord. One of the most important passages in that is Romans chapter 14, where Paul appears to be trying to settle a dispute between different groups of people who are having problems, who are having a lack of unity over how they should be operating. And they're causing divisions based off of these problems. And one of them is food, and whether you should eat meat sacrificed to idols. We've talked about that in a lot of different contexts, that that's a big problem. It's a big question in this day, is do you eat meat sacrificed to idols? And listen to what Paul says, Romans chapter 14 and verse 6 through 8. He says, he who observes the day observes it for the Lord, and he who eats does so for the Lord, for he give thanks to God, and he who eats not for the Lord, he does not eat and gives thanks to God. For not one of us lives for himself, and not one dies for himself. For if we live for the Lord, or if we die for the Lord. Therefore, whether we live or die, we are the Lord's. You see what Paul's focus is in this passage? He says the important aspect is not actually whether you eat or whether you don't eat the meat. You see the common phrase that was there is that when you do it, you give thanks to God. And he's going to tell people you want to make sure that you're following your conscience on this. You don't want to violate your conscience. But the most important facet of food for Paul is that it is a blessing from God. This is the reason we have the tradition of praying before we eat. And it derives, really, I think, directly from this passage. That is an attempt, and the reason we do that, while it can become a rote and routine thing, the reason we do that is to remind ourselves that this food is a blessing from God. And that this food should be used to give our bodies energy so that we may go about doing the work of the Lord. That's putting food in its proper context. That it is a good thing that has been given to us as a blessing from God, so enjoy the food you're about to eat. Whether it's simple food, whether it's delicious food, whatever food it may be, it is a blessing from God. It could be manna, it could be meat from Egypt. But it is a blessing from God, and it should be used to further the good things of God. That's the proper focus of food. But when food no longer becomes a blessing from God, but instead becomes a selfish activity devoted to our own pleasure, we are in danger of error. And do you see now why these things are described as dangerous thoughts? Because do you see the breeding grounds that this can cause? This group of people probably did not set out when they started eating meat to cause a potential division in the church. And yet, their attitudes towards food was so improper that they were in danger of splitting the Lord's body. That these people in Philippians chapter 3, when they ate, they're just thinking, hey, I'm just eating good food, and yet they have become so consumed with the pursuit of their physical desires that it has become their God. And that is where these things lead to destruction. And so I want to ask ourselves some things, and I'm going to ask ourselves some things that are stepping on my toes as well, because again, I am bigger than I should be. And I do think about that. I do concern myself and worry myself with what role food plays in my life. And one of the dangerous things about these thoughts that we talk about is there's a line that can blur sometimes in our head where we think, okay, well, this is a good thing. This has been given to us by God. But we start to cross that line and we start to get into this selfish pursuit of it, but we justify it by the good. And we're like, well, you know, I know I'm probably eating too much. I know I'm not sharing the food that I do have. I know I'm constantly thinking about food, but God gave me food. So isn't this a good thing? And that's the danger here, is in not having a clear conception of the role of food in our life. And so when food becomes a priority over other good things, you should be concerned. And again, this is not limited to stuffing your face. I'll give an example. You are so concerned about eating healthy. You are so concerned about making sure that you very carefully control what goes into your body. Perhaps for athletics reasons, perhaps for medical reasons, whatever it may be. But you spend a lot of time worrying about what kind of food goes into you. You don't overeat. If anything, you're closer to undereating. But you make sure that you're eating a specific regimented diet. Now, intrinsically, there's nothing wrong with that. I think there's actually even some good things to commend there about taking care of the body that God has blessed us with. But what happens when that desire to control exactly what you eat means you don't ever feel comfortable going to somebody else's house and eating their food? What happens when your desire to control what you eat means you don't want to go to, like, say, the potlucks that we hold here? Because you don't know what's in that food. You might not fit your calorie goal. It's going to be harder for you to eat. And so because you are so concerned about what goes into your belly, you don't spend time with your brethren. You don't break bread with them. Because you've got to really control what bread you're eating. That is gluttony. You're not overeating. You're not fat. You're not stuffing your face. But your God has become your belly. And you have become over-concerned with food to the detriment of your relationship with your brethren. That is gluttony. And that is when a good thing, a blessing from God, has become a dangerous thought and a stumbling block. What about when we use food as comfort? Now again, remember what Ecclesiastes says, there is natural comfort in good food. Good food is a balm to the soul. It's a pleasurable thing. It reminds us of the blessings of God. But what happens when food becomes something we self-medicate with? What happens when food becomes our tool of choice to soothe our fears and concerns rather than turning to the Lord? Where food becomes our comforter. Where when we are in a difficult situation, our temptation is not to go to God, is not to turn to our brethren for aid, but to instead assuage our bellies and to fill them with good things. Again, we're taking a good thing and we're misprioritizing it. We're letting a good thing rule us instead of having the self-control to control those things. There was a C.S. Lewis, when he wrote the Screwtape Letters, he had a passage that has just always stuck with me, and he was talking about gluttony. And the Screwtape Letters, if you're not familiar, the conceit is that it's a older demon talking to a younger demon about how to effectively tempt mankind. And that seems like kind of a weird description, but it's really eye-opening. And in talking about gluttony, the elder demon talks about one of the people that he's seen. And he says she's a glutton, even though she never eats very much food. But he says, what do quantities matter, provided we can use a human belly and palate to produce querulousness, impatience, uncharitableness, and self-concern? She never recognizes as gluttony her determination to get what she wants, however troublesome it may be to others. That's insightful. And he goes on to talk about how this woman, she every time a plate comes out, she's like, oh, no, that's far too much food for me. Just take it back and give me just a quarter of that. And he says she's a nightmare to servers and to waitresses because everything becomes about conforming to her desires and her goals. And her God has become her belly. And the demon says, and she has no idea. Because she thinks because she's not eating very much food, she's not in any danger of gluttony. I want us to think about this. Because it can be a problem. And again, our cultural conception of gluttony tends to be surely, is your weight okay? And so those of us who are overweight tend to worry about this a lot. And those of us who are not overweight maybe don't think about this as much, because you think, okay, well, I'm thin, I don't have a bad relationship with food. But the problem is not what your physical body looks like. The problem is, how are you using a gift from God, and are you using it to His glory or to your own pleasure? Here's another one that maybe steps on toes. What percentage of our budget does food take up? What percentage of our budget does charity take up? Do we spend hundreds of dollars a month feeding ourselves with our favorite snacks and our favorite foods, making sure we have a good full belly? And then when we pass somebody homeless, we think, ah, if only I had a little bit more money in my pocket. Do we think, ah, sure would be nice to contribute more to the work here at West Oaks? I wish there was more money. And then we spend hundreds and hundreds of dollars on going out to eat. My budget doesn't look very good when I ask that question of myself. And it's meant to be. Looking at sin is not meant to be just a reaffirmation of good job, pat on the back, go keep doing your life. When we look at sin, we should look at ourselves, not only should we ask, am I just completely fallen? We should ask, how can I do better? And that's one of the things that I want us to talk about with this, is I don't merely want to identify gluttony as a problem. I want to ask us, how do we overcome this dangerous thought? How do we avoid our God becoming our belly and our desires? Well, Paul, unsurprisingly for someone who talks so much about this, has some really good suggestions. If you go over to 1 Corinthians chapter 9, and again, I think Paul is talking about more than just food, but I think it very much applies to our discussion here. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9, one of the more famous analogies he gives, he says in verse 24 of chapter 9 of 1 Corinthians, he says, Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may win. Everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. They then do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. Therefore, I run in such a way as not without aim. I box in such a way as not beating the air, but I discipline my body and make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified. Paul says, I've got to work on stuff. I have to train myself. I have to cut things out that are harmful. If you ever look at any athlete, whether it's, you know, Olympic athlete in 100 AD or modern Olympic sprinter, they discipline their body. And they not only train their body, they make sure they're very careful about what comes in and out of their body. They train, they're disciplined, they have self-control. They know that, you know, eating a whole gallon of ice cream might taste really good, but it's going to hinder my ultimate goal. And so they tend to be very controlled over what they do. That's the type of control that we have to be looking for. That through the power of God, we strive to bring our body under discipline and self-control. And again, this is about more than just not overeating. This is about placing our body in the proper context. It's not that it doesn't matter, because our bodies do matter. Our bodies are temples. God has given us our bodies as a gift. But the ultimate purpose of food is to glorify God. That food is used as energy that allows us to go and do the good things we need to do, that allows us to go do the work of the kingdom. And so we discipline ourselves. And so if you struggle with overeating, if food becomes this thing that you gorge yourself upon, that it becomes this comforting thing, perhaps fasting is a good tool. Perhaps being very deliberate about cutting out some of those food items, cutting out some of those meals, perhaps that is a good practice to undergo. To discipline your body. To bring it under self-control. To not let your desires rule you. And perhaps in the other way. Perhaps if food has become an obsession, not because you overeat it, but because you're so concerned about eating it. Perhaps it would be better to loosen things up. It would be better to gain 10 pounds than to have a life ruled by an improper desire. It would be better to be out of shape than to be so concerned with food that you've missed the glory of God. Now, I'm saying all these things with the reality that I don't know what your relationship with food is. Even those of you who I've seen at potlucks, I don't really know what your relationship with food is. And again, I don't want this to be the takeaway, is that if I overeat one time and get a stomach ache, I've somehow committed a grievous sin. That's not the point of what we're talking about here. This is not you overate, you ate two hamburgers instead of one time. The point is to deeply look at your relationship. To deeply look at how you use food, and are you using it in that Romans 14 way? That it is a blessing from God that you appreciate as a blessing from God and use to glorify God throughout your time. And so in working against gluttony, we want to practice discipline and we want to practice self-control. But one of the things about sin is that it is not enough to simply stop doing something. If you ever talk or if you ever have looked at the 12 steps or if you ever looked at advice on how to recover from drugs or alcohol or any other type of addiction, one of the things they will always tell you is that you have to find something to fill that void. Because if you just stop doing something and you don't do anything else, eventually you'll fall back to that. Because you need something to fill that time, to fill that space, to fill that emotional need. And so as we are excising the sins in our life and removing these things and being changed by God, God is also trying to put good things in our life. So turn over to me, the final passage we'll look at. A fascinating one in Isaiah chapter 58. Again, the Bible talks more about this topic than I think we sometimes think. And in Isaiah 58, in the midst of talking about what a faithful people will look like, about what a righteous people filled with the works of God will look like, the prophet Isaiah says in chapter 58 and verse 6, the Lord says, "Is this not the fast which I choose, to loosen the bonds of wickedness, to undo the bands of the yoke, and to let the oppressed go free and break every yoke? Is it not to divide your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into the house, when you see the naked to cover him and not to hide yourself from your own flesh? Then your light will break out like the dawn, and your recovery will speedily spring forth, and your righteousness will go before you. The glory of the Lord will be your rear guard. Then you will call, and the Lord will answer. You will cry, and he will say, 'Here I am.' If you remove the yoke from your midst, the pointing of the finger and speaking wickedness, and if you give yourself to the hungry and satisfy the desire of the afflicted, then your light will rise in darkness, and your gloom will become like midday." Isaiah says, you know what one of the other purposes of food is? It's to share it. We talked about this in the adult Bible classes. We talked about the idea of sharing with all needs, that the Bible is very anti-individualism. It's very against the idea that I am an island to myself and all my stuff is mine and I'm to focus on my things and everything is mine and everything else is yours. But you stay away from mine. Isaiah says, decades, centuries before Christ comes, he says, you are to care for those in more need than you. That your food is not merely to fill your belly, but it is to uplift the weak. It is to uplift those who do not have. And so a lot of times when dangerous thoughts, when these sins are discussed, there's a virtue that goes along with it. And the idea is that as you are working to remove yourself from this sin, you are filling that time with a good thing. And so I would suggest to you that the virtue to fill the place of gluttony is charity. When food is so unimportant to you, when food is placed in the proper context for you, food becomes a gift to share with others. It becomes something that is not solely about filling the pleasures of yourself, but it becomes a blessing from God that you wish to share with others. And so as we consider these things, consider perhaps, even if you eat three fairly square meals a day, even if perhaps you do not struggle with overeating or undereating, question whether you have given enough to charity. I can confess, you probably haven't. I haven't. Because we should always be looking for how we can be more charitable. And this is one of the beautiful things about studying sin, is that that study never ends. Because even if you have overcome gluttony, one, you have to always be on guard to watch yourself against temptation. But there's always virtue to grow in as we move further away from sin. There's always room for us to be more giving. There's room for us always to be more like God in what we do. And so this is what we want to do with this series, is to ask ourselves, are we struggling with this? If we are struggling with this, how can we work against this? And if we're not struggling with this, how can we help those who are? How can we be of more virtue? And how can we be more like the Spirit that God has planted within us? And so gluttony, perhaps, when you first think about it, might seem a thing that, you know, there's very little point to this. I'm not an overeater. I don't struggle with this. But you can see how this obsession with food, it's more than just overeating. It's an improper placement of desire. And we can all struggle with that. And so I encourage you to think on these things. Think on how your relationship with food is either drawing you closer to God or drawing you further away from God. The first couple of lessons we're going to be talking about are going to be dealing with things of the body. And our bodies are good gifts. They are blessings from God. But they are the things that have been most affected by sin, most affected by the corruption that we face. That the good gifts that God has given us in our body become corrupt. They become temptations and problems for us. And Christ came to redeem those things. Christ came, and I so appreciated Zach's prayer this morning, as he talked about Jesus Christ, the perfect human. Look at what Jesus does with food. Look through the Gospels and see how he utilizes food. But his priority is he teaches his apostles to pray. Is pray for your daily bread. Pray for enough to be filled. Pray that you may have what you need to go work for the glory of the Lord. And then the rest? Go use it for the glory of God. Christ has come to redeem who we are. Not just to save us in a distant future, but to transform us in the here and now. To change us from people whose God is our bellies, to people who place our desires in their proper context. This is what Christ has done for us. And so if you find yourself struggling in that capacity, if you find yourself overcome with those desires, I will tell you now, you can't overcome it by yourself. But through Jesus, through the Spirit that comes upon you through baptism, now that has a transformative power. And if you find yourself in need of that in any capacity, I would encourage you to do so and let us know while we stand and while we sing.